Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay. Hello again. So we'll start this afternoon session, which will be more specifically about social determinants of mental health among adults and maybe even a bit older adults in the second half. So we start with Professor Mauricio Avendaño, who is professor at the University of Lausanne and co-director of the Health Economics and Policy Unit at the Department of Epidemiology and Health Systems at Unisanté. He's also co-director of the Lausanne Center for Health Economics, Behavior and Policy. He's a quantitative social scientist doing research on the impact of public policies and social changes on global health inequalities. And he's also adjunct associate professor at the Harvard School of Public Health and visiting professor of global health and public policy at the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at King's College London. So, Mauricio, yes, the floor is yours.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Maria, for this invitation. It's really, really nice to see all these presentations, and I'm really excited to be able to share this paper with you. So this is the first time that I present this paper, so I hope you'll forgive when you present something for the first time, it's hard. But also, unlike the other presentations, I'm only going to talk about one single paper. So I hope it's not too boring to talk about one single paper, but hopefully this will bring some interesting additional insights. So this is what I'm going to present to you today. It's a paper that I have been working on for the last 4 years. I really put my heart into this project, and it's a project funded by the Swiss National Scientific Agency together with the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation as part of this program, which is called Solution Oriented Research for Development in Switzerland. It's a collaboration with a team, especially Nathalie Monet and Armando Meyer, who are the kind of leading authors of this paper that I'm going to be talking about today. And just to show you, it's a big collaboration between people in Colombia, in Switzerland, and in the UK. Okay, so I'm going to have a very structured, this is a very Swiss presentation. I'm going to be talking first about why do we want to do this study, tell you a little bit about the context, the project, and why we did it. I'm going to tell you about this youth well-being, which is the intervention that we did, the study design, the results, and the conclusion. So let me start a little bit with the motivation. So this particular paper, it's a little bit different from the other papers that we've heard today. Because we've been talking so far about how the social environment, for example, exposure to poverty, as we heard in the beginning from David, how that influences risk factors for mental health problems, for depression and anxiety. So we've been so far interested in how poverty influences mental health. But since this paper, or maybe for a long time already, but this paper in Science by Ridley and colleagues formalized this idea of a mental health poverty cycle in which poverty does not only influence mental health, but also mental health can be a way or a mechanism that can take us into poverty itself, because it can influence, for example, our ability to work. It can influence the ability of children to concentrate and to do well at school. And this, in the long term, can also lead to poverty risk. So this is what we call the mental health and poverty cycle. So this idea that mental health is not only the result of poverty, but mental health can also influence what we call human capital accumulation, the ability to build skills, and then the ability to work. So this presentation is really, concerned with this last part here of how mental health influences academic performance and labor productivity. And what I'm going to show you is some study trying to disentangle a little bit this question. Now, why is it important to think about this kind of reverse association, not only how poverty influences mental health, but also how mental health influences social outcomes? And one reason to do that is because, as many of you know, many mental health problems start very early in life. If you take many different disorders, this is data from the OECD, you'll see that the majority of mental health problems start already by the age of 14 and 15. So people who have, for example, anxiety, the average age at which anxiety starts to develop is at the age of 10 or 11. And other disorders, such as impulse control disorder, also starts around the age of 10. So actually, mental health problems are already starting before people even maybe define their adult socioeconomic status or their income later in life. And all of these things that happen early could have profound consequences for their social and life trajectories later on. Now, I pick up this data to illustrate a little bit this example. This is some work by Janet Curry and colleagues in the US and Canada that try to see how the intensity of different mental health problems relates to school outcomes. So what you see here in this x-axis here, it's a score that tells us how intense a mental health problem is. So for example, hyperactivity, children that are here in the upper part of the graph have more symptoms of hyperactivity than children here. And what you see here is the probability of being at school at the age of 16 to 19. So it's a way to see how the intensity of our mental health problems relate to the probability that we are still at school at the age of 16 to 19. And what you see, it's a very strong relationship. So children who have more symptoms of hyperactivity, as you might guess, or anxious depression or antisocial behavior, they're much more likely to leave school. They're much more likely to not be in school at the age of 16 to 19. This is true in the United States, certainly very linear association. It is true in Canada too. The association is less linear, but we see the same pattern in which the probability of being at school is there. So if we would take any indicator of school performance, for example, grades, for example, the probability of failing a course, we will see a very similar result. When children have mental health problems, they're much more likely to experience difficulties at school, which is really what we, I'm sure many of you know this maybe by your own experience of or things that you've seen in your own life. Now, mental health is also influences very strongly our ability to work. Here, I just show you some very simple graph that shows just the probability of being absent from work in the past 4 weeks, according to the severity of a mental health disorder. And what we see here is that people who have a severe mental health disorders are much more likely to report that they have been absent from work in the last 4 weeks compared to those who have no mental disorder. Okay, so mental health is not only the results of things that happen in our social environment, it can potentially also have implications for our ability to study, to build up human capital, but also to work. So there's this strong correlation between the two things. Now, how is this possible? And many of these things, I think, resonates with things that you already know, but why is mental health important to education and work? Now, mental health can be seen as a barrier, if you like, to human capital accumulation. And in economics, when people say human capital accumulation, refers to everything that will lead to some kind of productivity. It could be learning skills, could be actually working, anything that that will lead to kind of productivity. So how mental health can be a barrier to human capital accumulation, and this can happen by many mechanisms, and I'm citing some of them here. Mental health problems can lead to reduced concentration, loss of energy and motivation, and this will weaken our ability to acquire skills and also lower our lower academic signals. Another mechanism that is commonly mentioned in economics is that mental health problems can influence our the way we discount the future. So we may think that the future is less important and we may make decisions of underinvesting our education and our career. So that's a potential consequence of mental health problems. There's also evidence suggesting that depression or anxiety, for example, can have cognitive effects and affects cognitive functioning, which may also impair our ability to plan for the future, to make decisions, and to pursue goals. Everything that has to do with self-regulation. Mental health problems can also lead to reduced perseverance and self-esteem and self-control, so non-cognitive skills as well, which will lead in generally to low engagement and less resilience. And in general, when we have, for example, symptoms of depression or anxiety, we are less likely to perceive ourselves as able to achieve what we want to achieve. So lower perceived ability may also lead to less incentives to stay at school and less incentives to pursue long-term employment. So mental health for two individuals, if you like, that will have the same skills or the same ability, but one of them has, for example, depression or anxiety and the other doesn't, you will see that those with depression and anxiety symptoms will be less likely to engage with studying or have more difficulties to engage with studying as a result, presumably, of those symptoms of depression and anxiety. So this is a little bit what the theory will tell us, and we would expect then depression and anxiety to have then strong impacts. There has been a lot of research showing that these links exist. So mental health is related to education outcomes and to work outcomes. But there are a number of gaps in these studies that I wanted to highlight. So One of the points, and this is usual almost to any subject of research, most of the research on this topic has been conducted in high-income countries and on what I call regular students, or students that are at high school, most of them, sometimes at university. But there's very little research on vulnerable students, so students from low income or students that have been victims of conflict and of difficult circumstances. And especially there's very little research on this question in low and middle income countries, settings, where the impacts of mental health, for example, in the case of conflict, can be quite important. So one of the things that I want to try to do today is to show you this study that we've been doing in a country that has been through conflict in a low and middle income country setting. Now, the other challenge is that because there is this bidirectional relationship between mental health and education, it is actually quite difficult to know what is driving this relationship. Do people who do maybe not so well at school have more mental health problems because perhaps their poor school outcomes lead to more mental health problems? Or is it so that mental health problems really lead to poor educational outcomes? Or is there something common to mental health and also to education, such as maybe some parenting practices that may affect both, but maybe they are both not causally related? Now, most of these studies that exist have been primarily observational that show this correlation, but it's really quite difficult to establish whether this relationship is causal. And this is quite important, and I learned this from Lisa Bergman, who is here. If you really want to know whether intervening on something will lead to a different outcome, then you have to know that that relationship is causal. So if you really want to know that improving mental health is going to lead to better educational outcomes, then we need to know whether that relationship is really causal, whether change in mental health really leads to changes in educational outcomes. And finally, most of the studies that have looked at these relationships have been studies in the context of young students, a lot of them looking at hyperactivity and those kinds of symptoms that are common among students at high school, but there's or small children, but there's less research looking at how mental health affects the educational outcomes of higher education students. And this is kind of the context in which we are doing this study. So let me tell you a little bit about the context. So this is a study that moves us really far away. So this is a study in Colombia. I'm not sure, maybe some of you have been to Colombia, but just in case, I thought I would put a map here. This is the United States that maybe most of you know. And this is Colombia here at the top of South America. It's quite interesting because a couple of years ago, there was this, I read this in the newspaper that says that Colombia, and not Finland, is the happiest country in the world. And this kind of has been repeatedly found that Colombians, they actually report themselves to be quite happy compared to other countries. And when I see this, I grew up in Colombia myself, so I kind of I know what they mean when they say that Colombians actually be very happy. And if you've been to Colombia, you'll see these kind of faces. We don't have time to discuss why this might be the case, but I think what I wanted to point here is that Colombia is a country that has faced actually very difficult circumstances over the last 50 years, as some of you might know. And this is, I wanted to show just two photographs from Jesus Abad Colorado. He's a very well-known photographer in Colombia who has photographed the conflicts. And these are two examples of cases of victims of the conflict in Colombia that has lasted 50 years, either from the paramilitaries or from the left-wing guerrillas. So there's a long history of conflict that has left actually a very large imprint on the mental health of the entire population. He himself, as a photographer, was kidnapped twice. I think we all Colombians relate in some ways to what the conflict has been. So the context of Colombia is a country with a relatively high poverty rate, despite being classified as an upper middle income country, around 36% live in monetary poverty. And importantly for this study, there is a large educational gap. Around half or more than half of students from high income families go to university, as opposed to only 9% of children from low income families. So that's about six times less likely to go to university if you come from a low income background. And as I said, there is this kind of large 50 year plus armed conflict that left a lot of kind of change in the country, poverty, but also displacement, with many millions of displaced populations and mental health consequences. There was an agreement in 2006 that ended the conflict with one of the main guerrillas that led to a massive reduction, as you see here, in deaths related to the conflicts. But many of the consequences of this conflict, of course, will persist for many decades to come. Now, what is also interesting from Colombia is that similar to Brazil, for example, or Mexico, is a country that has expanded massively its social protection system, especially, as is the case of most of Latin America, through some kind of what we call conditional cash transfer programs. So these are programs that provide financial support to families or to young people for different purposes under the condition that they meet some criteria. So this is the context in which this study happens, and what I'm going to show you is a study that we did in one of these major social protection programs that was introduced in the early 2000s that is called Renta Joven, Young Income. It's a program that essentially is managed by the Department of Social Prosperity, which was a direct collaborator on this project. So we work directly with this government agency, which is responsible for the reduction of poverty and inequality in Colombia. And the purpose of that program that existed before this project is to address the longstanding inequalities in education that I was mentioning before by supporting young people, so adults from 18 to 28, in going to college, actually. So they provide them with financial support to be able to go to college. This is really unprecedented. This many of those young people would never go to college if they wouldn't get this support. And it's quite large scale. It covers, in the beginning, it was about 500,000. At the moment, it covers around 360,000 young people that are enrolled in higher or vocational education nationwide. And the program, what it does is that it provides this conditional cash transfer to these young people under the condition that they first continue to be enrolled at university, and second, that they have a grade point average above 3 out of 5. So they don't have to have a super high grade point average, but they have to still pass their grades. If they get a higher GPA 4, then they get an additional cash transfer. So this is a program that has been around since the early, around 2007 or so. It started and we wanted to work with the government to try to see how kind of mental health played a role in the success of the program. So one of the things that has come out from this evaluation of this program is that there is a very high prevalence of depression, anxiety, and PTSD. About a third of these young adults are victims of the conflict, and many of them have very high rates of these outcomes that were assessed in previous studies, depression, anxiety, and PTSD. And there is also a high dropout rate. So many of them drop out, not only because of mental health, but we wanted to basically intervene on mental health because it's one of the main reasons that appear to be they're contributing to the high dropout rate from their studies at university and vocational education. Okay, so that is hopefully that gives you a little bit of the context. And so let me tell you a little bit about what our aim was. So our aim with this study was to really co-develop, implement, and evaluate the impact of a digital mental health intervention that I'm going to describe in a moment on both mental health and educational outcomes among these vulnerable young people who benefited from the Renta Joven program in Colombia. So the idea here is that instead of looking at the correlation between mental health and education, we are actually going to intervene through a digital mental health platform to improve mental health, and then we're going to see whether these improvements in mental health translate into improvements in educational outcomes. Okay, so it's a way to study a question. We also wanted to actually improve mental health mainly, but we wanted to see also whether these improvements translate into better educational outcomes. And so what we do in this study is to assess basically our research questions are basically three questions: to what extent having access to these digital mental health technologies that have been shown to improve mental health, deployed at scale, because we do it in this very large sample of students, to what extent they can improve mental health, to what extent do they improve educational outcomes, and here we're looking at grade point average and to their retention in higher education. And then we look at some outcomes that we won't have much time to discuss today, but we also look at future orientation, so their educational investments, and their expectations on earnings and GPA in the future. So it's really trying to disentangle to what extent improving mental health can improve both mental health as well as educational outcomes. So this youth well-being, Bienestar Joven, it's the name of the intervention that we developed. We developed it with psychiatrists, with psychologists in Colombia, but also we work with members of the government and we work with young people through a very kind of rigorous co-design process to be able to do something that was relevant for them. It's an intervention, digital intervention, very much based on a transdiagnostic approach. It means that it does not only focuses on one outcome, it focuses on depression, anxiety, and PTSD and the common symptoms across these three conditions. It is based on cognitive behavioral therapy principles. So here on the On the right, you see that it's an intervention that has six modules dealing with things like behavioral activation, problem solving, interpersonal effectiveness, and also it has a kind of regulation, emotional regulation toolbox to help students. It lasts 10 weeks, so we expect people to be able to go through the whole process in about 10 weeks. And it's based really on a very kind of careful review of interventions that are effective. There are many, many digital interventions and many studies that have looked at this. And so we did this kind of basic, very, very detailed review of this to develop this intervention, working with a technology company. And then I won't talk much about it, but for some students, we also included a peer support program, basically to support them in using the platform. So one of the challenges, as you will see, with this kind of digital interventions is that it's very hard to convince the young people to use them. So we wanted to have a peer support program that will help them to actually, not to treat any symptoms, but to really motivate the students to actually use the platform. So this is what it looks like. So people enter the platform and then they can do different kind of exercises there. They have a lot of videos, and then they also have a forum in which which was managed by a group of psychologists in which they could discuss mental health problems and so on. So what we did in this study was to do what we call a randomized controlled trial, in which we actually invited the 350,000 students that were enrolled there to fill up a survey. We got 70,000 responses. And then, just going very quickly here, we ended up with about 19,000 people who completed the baseline survey, where we assessed a number of questions, including mental health outcomes. And then we excluded those who didn't have any symptoms, so around 3,000, and those who were very high risk, which we thought were not appropriately addressed. Their problems wouldn't be properly addressed with this platform. They were referred to a psychologist and then to external support in the region where they lived. And then what we did was to take this around 14,600 young people in this program, and we randomized them to either get access to the digital platform or to be in the control group, which I will explain in a moment. And then we follow them up just in the follow-up one after the 3 months, they're finishing the intervention, and then 3 months later. Now, we have other follow-ups, but I'm only going to talk about these two follow-ups for now. Now, what's really nice here is that we work with the government, so we had also access to administrative data on their grades, because the government needs to verify their grades and whether they are still enrolled in university to be able to see whether they comply with the conditions for the cash transfer. So it was really nice to work with them because we had access for the majority of them, for those who agreed to have their data linked to administrative data from their grades and their university outcomes. So we did this randomization, and I don't want to go into much detail, but we basically separated these students between students who had only mild symptoms, those who had moderate symptoms, and those who had severe symptoms. And then for each of these three groups, we randomized them to either the control group, which was basically basic information about mental health resources available on where they live, or to have access to the platform. So they get a link, they have a code to access the link, and then they can use the platform for three months. And then we did the same for the moderate and severe groups, but we also randomized the treatment group into having only the platform or to having the platform plus the support of peers who will help them or guide them through the intervention. I'm only going to show you results that compare the control to the treatment group, but this is kind of the way we designed this study. Now, very quickly, we looked at different outcomes. Our main outcome was measured through the PHQ-9, which is a 9-item scale from depression, and the anxiety GAD-7. And what we constructed was a combined severity outcome. What I'm going to show you is a combined outcome that looks at PHQ and ADS that combines both anxiety and depression. Those are our primary outcomes. We also have a PTSD scale that we look at. And for education, we looked at retention, so the probability that they're still at school at the time of the assessment. And also we look at the grade point average, the cumulative grade point average, with the idea that to see whether the intervention improved their educational outcomes. Then we have a number of educational outcomes that are secondary outcomes. Maybe the more interesting one is this scale of behavioral activation. So behavioral activation is one of the main mechanisms in cognitive behavioral therapy through which we expect to improve symptoms of depression and anxiety. And then so higher scores means an improvement, and that was more of a kind of an assessment of a mechanism. So what we did, or what I'm going to show you, are the results of a regression model in which we model the mental health outcomes as a function of being in the treatment and control group, then controlling for baseline values of depression, anxiety, and PTSD, as well as all of these socioeconomic demographic variables. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about the results. So to tell you again, first on the descriptives, this population has very high rates of depression and anxiety symptoms. So around 26% of them have severe symptoms, and other 25% have moderate symptoms. So about half have serious symptoms, and about 8% of them were in the highest risk category and therefore excluded from the study. And just to show you, in this sample that we have, in the sample of around 19 students, we also see a very strong correlation between mental health and educational outcomes. Just to give you an example here, we have the score of the PHQ-ADS, so the intensity of symptoms of depression and anxiety. So the more symptoms you have of anxiety, the lower your grade point average. So just as we would expect, worse mental health is associated with lower performance, if you like to measure this with GPA, with the point average. And this is true also for hours of study. The more mental health problems, the less students who study, or the more mental health problems, also the less educational investment, the less they pass time studying. So this is just to show you the correlation. This is not the result, but just to show you in this sample, there is also a very strong correlation between mental health and educational outcomes. Now, this is the first table in a randomized control trial. You want the treatment group and the control group to be very similar. You don't want them to be different, because otherwise you can't attribute any difference to the treatment group. I'm sure you all will memorize this table very well, but just to tell you, there's no significant difference at baseline in the main variables between treatment and control, so that is good news. And here is kind of the main result of the trial. So this line here shows this is what you see here is an estimate with 90% confidence intervals. Everything that is around the zero line means no effect, and everything that's to the left means a reduction of symptoms. So what you see here is that the interventions led to a significant, statistically significant, but small reduction in symptoms of depression and anxiety. This is depression, this is anxiety. And also a small reduction in the symptoms of PTSD. This is the first follow-up. In the second follow-up, we see still a reduction that is maintained. 3 months later, there's still a lower rates of symptoms in the treatment group versus the control group. So those who had the intervention had less symptoms. The effect is smaller, but it's still significant, except for PTSD, in which the effect becomes a little bit larger. So in a way, this is kind of good news in terms of the effects of mental health. We see that this digital intervention, even though it's very light, no? It's just, you know, you have this digital intervention, you enter, you do some exercises, but even then we see some improvements in symptoms that are significant, even though they are smaller than we would like, but they are significant. Now, one of the challenges with these interventions, as I was saying, is that it's very hard to convince people to use them. And actually, among all of those 7,000 people who were given access to the intervention in these 3 months, only around 30% of them actually follow the program. So we look at the impact of using the program, basically correcting for the fact that only a small fraction, 30%, actually use the program. Now, we do this with something which is called an instrumental variable analysis, in which we looked what was the impact of the treatment on those who were actually treated. So this is what we called the late estimate. And what you see here is that the effect then becomes much, much larger. So everything that is kind of 0.25 or smaller is a small effect. Above 25, this is kind of a medium-sized effect. So this is not so different from the effect that you would expect from psychotherapy. And I hope I'm not offending any psychotherapists here, but I mean, the effect is maybe a little bit inflated by the way we do it, but it's a relatively big effect. If you do actually use the platform, you can see significant reductions in symptoms of depression and anxiety. Something that is interesting is that we see also a quite strong effect on the behavioral activation score. So one of the things that the program seemed to have done is that increased really these indicators of behavioral activation, that people, when they have symptoms of depression, actually become behaviorally active, that they do things as a way to deal with their symptoms. And this seems to be one of the main mechanisms to which this effect may have happened. So far, I think this is kind of good news. The symptoms seem to have declined. However, when we look at the educational outcomes, and this we looked at mostly with the administrative data, we actually did not find any evidence that these improvements in education and mental health symptoms translated in improvements in grade point average, which is kind of our main outcome, and also in the probability of dropping out. Now, one thing to take into account is that this is a very short period of time. So we have around 3 to 6 months of time. So this may be very short for us to see a change in GPA. This is a cumulative GPA. So if you were already 8 semesters, for example, this is the average across the 8 semesters. So maybe it was actually too harsh to find an effect. But in this small time window, we didn't see an effect on those two main outcomes, but also not on their expected cumulative GPA. Now, an effect that we saw that emerged in the second follow-up was a reduction in their expected earnings. What this is a question about what do you think will be your salary when you graduate? And this is a question that is used in often used by economists to look at expectations, because there is this strong link. If you're having symptoms of depression, you're less likely to be positive about how much you will earn in the future. And it seems like people are more optimistic about their earnings if they actually went through the intervention. So we see this kind of a small positive effect on expected earnings. As before, once we look at those who actually use the platform, we also see no effects here, but the effect on expected earnings and maybe on educational investments become a little bit larger. Just to finalize the results, one thing that I think it's important is that we looked separately at those who had symptoms that were moderate or severe versus those who had mild symptoms. And in general, what we see here is that the effect of this intervention on mental health outcomes was primarily strong on those who had moderate or severe symptoms. So it really kind of seems like it would make sense to really target these interventions to those who had some symptoms that were significant rather than those with kind of relatively mild symptoms. So just to summarize, I think it's good for this kind of study is that we saw these significant and immediate reductions in depression, anxiety, and PTSD that persisted at 3 months. But we didn't see any effects on most educational outcomes, except for some suggested gains in educational investments and maybe unexpected earnings. Now, we also saw that the severity at the baseline really mattered, that those with more gains were those who had symptoms that were moderate or severe at the beginning. And I didn't show you this, but we didn't find that the peer support program actually made a difference to the effect of the intervention. A little bit to conclude, I think what this study really shows is that these digital interventions can be scaled up in a major social protection system. And these effects that we saw are maybe a little bit smaller from other studies that have looked at digital interventions, but this is also something that happens when you kind of do real life trials, where you look at what happens when you scale up a program at a very large scale, as it was done in this study. But it was really puzzling why we don't see these improvements in mental health translated in measurable kind of educational outcomes. And we have 3 kind of possible explanations. One of them is that these increases in mental health or mental well-being were not sufficiently large to translate into educational benefits. And maybe this is important because we offer students these digital apps, but maybe the changes that it generates are not enough to generate changes. The second explanation is that there was too low engagement with only around 29% of them using the platform. And this is probably one of the main explanations that we think explains the results. And maybe there's a time horizon issue. So we are looking at this in a very short term, sort of 3 to 6 month period. And maybe we need more time to look at the effects on GPA. And this is kind of something that we're trying to do now. So just as a take home message, digital mental health interventions can produce meaningful symptom reduction, and they can be deployed at scale in low and middle income countries and university settings. However, these engagement challenges mean that maybe their effectiveness is limited and may not always translate into spillover effects to educational outcomes. Thank you very much. I'm happy to take any questions.
Collège de France. Le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.